Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Port of Harlem Talk Radio, and I'm your host and also publisher of Port of Harlem Magazine at portofharlem.net. If you're listening via the internet, you can type your question in the comment box. You can also call to listen by dialing on your phone at 516-531-9540. And if you want to also ask a question, after you are connected, press 1 and please be in a quiet place. You can also visit portofharlem.net and click Port of Harlem Talk Radio from the menu to hear this and past episodes. We're also available on about 7 podcast platforms. And lastly, We Talk Production sponsors Port of Harlem Talk Radio. Our first guest is Dr. Dwayne Dice, chair of the Jamaica Diaspora Education Task Force, where one of his goals is to empower fatherless youth to know that it is okay to share their story openly and without shame. In the Port of Harlem article, Growing Up Fatherless Yet Becoming an Empowered Parent, Dice shares his experiences growing up without a father, his search for his father, and his unexpected outcome. Dice also shares how his child experiences affect his parenting his daughter. In about 20 minutes, Franklin Malone, founder and CEO of 100 Fathers, will join us. Malone offered these words before today's show. He told me, quote, "Fatherhood cannot be caught, it cannot be bought, it has to be taught," unquote. His organization leads fathers to a greater involvement with their children and families. Malone also hosts the internet radio show Fatherhood Next Level Empowerment Hour. So let's move on with the conversation and let's welcome Dr. Dice. How are you doing this afternoon?
I'm fine, thank you. Thank you for having me on your show.
Well, thanks for taking the time to share your experiences with our readers. And of course, they could read it at portofharlem.net. In the article, you speak of being ashamed of being fatherless. You wrote, quote, "I began wondering about our background because no one in our community looked like us. In the environment that you and your twin brother grew up in, was being mixed race a challenge as well?"
Well, growing up, we grew up in a community known as Murray Mountain, St. Anne, in the deep rural parish. It's a parish, one of the 14 parishes in Jamaica. It's about 4 to 5 hours drive from Kingston. So growing up there were mostly what you would refer to in America as African-Americans, growing up in that community. And they're mixed people with other races, like mixed blacks and whites, and so on. But there wasn't any Indian as such around. There were a few Indians very, very far away in some other communities. And they weren't, they didn't share our last name. So in our immediate family, and also our neighbors growing up, we look around when we're little. And I said we because it's myself and my twin brother growing up there, looked around when it was that time when we started to look and starting to question things, realizing that even our own family we're growing up with, they didn't resemble us. And the only connection we had with our family, and the family I'm talking about here, is my grandparents that I grew up with. And they did not look like us. Not even my, it's one third Chinese grandfather. He was about a third or a little bit over a third Chinese. He didn't look like us. And my grandmother didn't look like us. We only had the connection with them through my mom, which is their daughter. So we started asking them, where are we from? And okay, they directed us to our mother. So it wasn't too much of a challenge to grow up as a mixed race child. But it's that time when we started to identify. And I mean, the time was around between 7 and 10 years old. I started to ask, who are we? What are we about, you know, in this community? Where are we from? And why are we in this community? And
so
they start with the directive.
So it wasn't so horrible growing up as a mixed race child, being mixed of African and Indian, or African, Indian, and Chinese, but just that no one else had that mixture that you had. Because other people you said were mixed with African and Chinese, African and white.
Yeah, there are a few. There are only a few there. You could count on one hand. Even my grandfather is just one mixed Chinese person in the community, and then his brother. And his brother wasn't even living there. That's my granduncle. He wasn't living there at the time. He was living in Montego Bay. And he wasn't even looking close to my grandfather. But that's another story that I probably should write a book about. So I started asking my grandfather. I said, we don't look like you. And we really don't look like our grandmother, even though we love them, and they know this. They know that we love them, but we wanted to find out our roots. And then we started asking our mom. The other people around, they were very much, they were mostly black, the people there. They're mostly black people. And the ones who were of mixed descent, they were older, and they would come to visit those other people there. So they were relatives. So basically, looking around, there wasn't any Indian descent. And we're half Indian, half black. We're more leaning towards the Indian side. And when you look, from my perspective, I look at my brother, I look at everybody who we were calling cousins, and they weren't nowhere near Indian. They weren't. They were looking like any Chinese to say, okay, they are descendant of so and so. Nobody there. So we were from somewhere else.
So the mixture itself didn't cause a problem. It's just that you didn't look like somebody else.
Right, right. The mixture was fine because most people in Jamaica, they're very mixed. Most people, they're very, very mixed. The African people who came and became enslaved in Jamaica, they mixed with other people, most of them. People outside of Jamaica usually wonder if Jamaicans, it's all black, and it's not accurate. Many Jamaican people, they are white, they're from white descent, even Syrian, German, they're descendants from there, Germany, and so on. They're descendants from England. They're many people come from China and mix with blacks. Many people from India, Indians, mix with blacks again. And then the Chinese mix with Indians, and the whites mix with all those mixed people. So it's many mixed races in Jamaica. It's very mixed. And that is why they coined the motto, Jamaican motto, is out of many, one people. Out of many, one people. So it is very mixed. So the mixed race wasn't a problem. I personally wanted to find out where I'm from because I didn't see a father, and I only saw my mother a few times when she would come and visit, and then she's gone again. And then she would write letters. But and so the void, I wanted to fill that void with some accurate story. And that's why I started this story.
Okay, so speaking of that void, one of our readers, Donovan Anderson, wrote to us, quote, I'm curious to why his mother refused to reveal who his father was at an earlier age. From the story, we know your mother was not forthcoming about your father's identity. But when she was ready, she took you and your twin brother to him. I know you're still in protective mode about your mother's stance, but have you talked to her about why she refused to reveal who your father was as he was growing up, or that's still a work in progress?
Yes, it's still it's somewhat revealed, but it's a little bit of a work in progress. Part of it that led us to eventually meet our biological father in Kingston was it's really the help of our mother. And over that, the void period of time, And I appreciate the question from the reader. The void of time there, it really means to me that my mom wanted some time to deal with this, because in the past, she tried, according to the stories, she tried to reveal who we were, by extension to where we're from, well, our father. But she was very reluctant in giving validity or even an accurate story, because she didn't know what would have happened afterwards. She didn't know what the repercussion might occur from my biological father's point, or from his angle, because he had a conversation with my mom many years before that. When we met him, we were just a couple of weeks before our 20th birthday. So we're looking at from 10, 11, 12, age 10, 11, 12, all the way to 19, almost 20, two weeks to our 20th birthday. And all that time, we have been asking every now and then, and we need to know this guy, we need to meet this guy. During that void, that time, there was the name Ramdeen came up. And we asked many times if this is real, if this is true. And she said yes. But the actual meeting, it was very difficult to get that part out. And I figured that she was going through some stressful decisions to be made later on, because we wouldn't drop it. We would never drop the idea of finding out who we are. It was a very stressful moment in our lives, going through that. So she had her own struggles at the time, but that does not give her any credence to hold that seriousness of the story from us, you know. And the fact that we were registered in another man's name, it doesn't give any credit to her not revealing who we are, even on paper. It doesn't. So we're still working through those, because I'm going to live with the name that I'm not changing my name. But it tells a lot about what's in the name.
Gotcha. So yeah. Donaldson Anderson also wrote that the response by your father, the one that he gave when you first met him, and his response was that generally that there was no reason for him to meet you now that you were a grown man. That was your father's response. And in Anderson's opinion, the reader, he said that he didn't think your father was being uncaring, but that could have been his father's way, your father's way of wondering where you were when you were younger, and why was this the first time he was meeting you as an adult. Is that a plausible interpretation from your perspective?
No. But I really appreciate him saying that. This is really good that he's grappling with the ideas behind the father. I appreciate him looking from the father's perspective, because the article is very short. If I should go into details, it will bring out some more parts to the story. But my biological father knew who we were a long time ago. He knew exactly who we were, and he refused to meet us years before that. He knew exactly who we were, because I didn't know this, that they were so close to us, and I didn't know. But I met my grandfather, his father, years before that, many years before that, when we were small. We used to go to Kingston to have summer break. On summer break, we would just go off to Kingston, and we would play in their yard. I had no idea that this guy was our grandfather, but my mom was in the yard to play. And he said, I want you to sit on his lap. I want you to talk to him. And we used to play in his hair, you know. And so we didn't meet the father, though. I didn't meet my father. They used to say, I remember my mom, I was about 8, 9, 10. My mom used to say that his son, who I wanted to meet, is not there now. He's at work. That's what she used to say. But I remember that old man used to look at me so hard. He used to look at us so hard. And I used to, I said, he's very creepy. Yeah.
You're trying to figure out why he was looking at you so hard.
Why, yeah. And my grandmother, who is his wife at the time, which would be my grandmother, she looked at us and she cooked for us. She cooked for us. And I used to wonder, why are we over that house? You know, all the time she would bring us over there to meet. I can't remember his name now, but we would meet him. And I said, I really, you know, many years after that, I asked, whatever happened to that guy? And she said, oh, you know, that was your grandfather. And I said, are you serious? Like, we were playing with our grandfather and I didn't even know. Are you serious? And she said, yeah, yeah. So I said, where's my father? And she said, I don't know. I don't know. So I said, we need to meet him. We really need to meet him. And at the time, I really wanted a father. I really wanted to be identified with a guy who looked just like us. And
exactly.
And then all that time, preteens, early teens, late teens, I started to drift away to the point of I don't really care about getting anything from him, because at the time I really needed money to go to school and the identity. I wanted to find out, I wanted to feel strength from a masculine figure as a father. And then all that just, it just faded. And all I cared about in my late teens, that was when I was getting into college, I said, I really don't care about getting anything from these people, because if he wanted to know me, he would have tried and get to know me. So all I need is just some connection. That's all. Biological connection. And so,
as you tell your story, I just want to stop for you 1 second, just so maybe you can expound a little more. I laughed only because, not that my experience was like yours, but I was maybe an adult at 40, and I was in Detroit visiting my aunt. And she took me over to the lady's house, and this lady runs out and says, you know, when you was a child, I used to cut your hair, but your father used to never let me cut your hair.
Mm-hmm.
And it ended up being my father's cousin. And to this day, it's his step cousin. And to this day, I'm figuring out, why did he never let her cut my hair, and why did he never identify her as a cousin?
Right.
And so it reminds me of you saying you go into this man's house and no one says this is your grandfather.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you're left wondering, and you're wondering with all these questions, or you're left with all these questions. Mm-hmm. So I can relate to that. Mm-hmm. So go ahead.
Oh yes, and looking back, you every story that you have had, because what happened inadvertently, all those things, you go back to all the times when you would go there to spend time, and all of those times starting to, it's like a domino effect with memories starting
exactly.
to go back in your mind. And you remember, and you remember, and you say, but they
and you
all.
And you re-question everything.
Yes. You started to request, and you stay up nights upon nights. I cried like a baby going to bed at night, thinking, "What is this? Why weren't they be very forthcoming this time? Because they had so many opportunities, both of them, my biological father and my mother. They both had so many options, so many avenues to share the stories, and they didn't. They refused to share it. And so when we were adults, we, you know, close to 20, we demanded that we need to close this door. We really need to close this door. It's opened and it's very crazy. It's very, very crazy. And the idea also was that growing up there, we started playing soccer in school. We played soccer and cricket everywhere. We played for all the schools we attended. And people used to say around us, but you guys don't belong here. You don't belong here. Where are you from? That's one of the things that when we're in our teens, many people just ask us in our community. And so that's kind of, it's like a fuel behind the search as well. So we decided that we really need to know where we're from, because if we don't belong here, even though we belong because our grandparents are there, where else would we belong? We don't belong over there. We don't belong in Kingston. We don't belong in Montego Bay. Where else do we belong? We need to belong somewhere, because we didn't drop from the sky. So we need to belong somewhere. And that's what pushed us to close the door and told her our mom. We said enough is enough. So back to the question, when the interpretation from the reader, I think Anderson, when my father said that, he wanted to reject us even more. He said, you're a big man now. You don't need a father. Why are you keep on looking back into the past thinking that you need a father? You don't need. And the conversation he had with my mom right in front of us, he said, why are you bringing them to us now, to me now? Why are you bringing them now all these years? Why are you bringing them to me now? And I don't really care about it right now. That's what he kept on going on about, that he knew exactly. My sisters, when I moved to the U.S., I reached out to some of my sisters. They're medical doctors in South Florida. And two of them, they didn't want to know. They said, one of them I called said that I should stop calling the phone because we are bastards and we are breaking up their family. So I said to her, but we are not the ones who brought us in your family. Your father brought us in. And so I said, it's okay, because I wanted the connection. I'm not asking for money or prestige or anything. I'm well off. I don't want anything. What I want is the connection, the human connection. And they refused it. They said that, no, we are from outside. We don't belong in their family.
These were his other children.
These were his legitimate in marriage children he had.
Okay.
So we were, okay. To close this little part, what I understand and I learned from my aunt, I got in touch with an aunt in New York years after. This was in 2016 or 15. I got in touch with the aunt. The aunt actually reached out to me. I wrote something on Facebook or so, and she found me, and she reached out and she said, I want to tell you everything. That's my brother. So my biological father, it's her brother. She said that he was married when he had us. He was married to another woman, and he had us on this outside of the relationship. He cheated on his wife to have us. So that's why they refer to us as quote-unquote bastard children, because we were not supposed to be made. And when we came around, he didn't want to know us. He knew of us, but he didn't want to know us. So he knew very long time ago.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, let's bring Frank into the conversation.
Yeah.
Frank, you've had lots of experiences with lots of people in lots of different situations. From your experiences with the men, boys, women, and girls who grew up without or are growing up without their fathers, what is your take on Dice's story, and do you have a question for Dice?
It's a very interesting story, and I feel the hole in his heart by the absence of his father. First, let's define what a father is: available, affirming, and authentic. Those three things constitute what a father actually is. And I believe that your search for that relationship was to fulfill the emptiness in your heart. Is that true? Dr.
Yeah,
Dyson?
Yes, very much so. Yeah.
And I'm looking at, you know, there's a couple of movies out. I don't know. You know, I have a book out, The Legacy of Fathers, The Promise, The Pain. But also, I've been in a couple of movies that are just about this. There's a movie that we have called Man Up.
Mm-hmm.
And there's another that Kenneth Braswell of Fathers Incorporated made called Spitting in Anger. Now, what we deal with usually is a child that doesn't have a father has the propensity to fail in school, to have behavioral problems, and to not go along with the mores of society. 65% of young men who were locked up never had a father. So you have done well, my friend, to deal with the exasperation over these years of not knowing who your father was. But the healing has to come when you understand that you have become the kind of father that your children will love. And and a lot of the research says, Dr. Dyson, that a lot of times, you know, I'm a master trainer all over the nation, hundreds of men. What we see is that some fathers make sure when they don't have a father that their children never suffer the indignity of not having a father in their life. Is that your story?
That is, yes, yes. That's the stance I've taken.
That's the grace that God has given you to follow through and to make up for what he's been unable to do. There's a movie I want you to see by Kenneth Braswell called Spitting in Anger, about the anger he had of not ever knowing who his father was. Finally, when he did find his father died shortly after that. But spitting in anger is what happens to a lot of men, that relationship, right? I'm glad to hear that you and your brother have been able to cope, compensate, and bring your life to a point where you can be great fathers and men. That's what's important about this. I also want to ask you a question about the hurt and the pain that you went through over the years. I'm looking at the determination and will of a young man to find out just who that father is. And I imagine this has been a yoke and a burden that you have carried for quite a while. Is that so, sir? Can you elaborate on that?
Yes. You said the will and hope that I carried?
Yes. Yes.
Well, part of it has to do with the church, because I grew up in the Catholic Church, and I was very close to pastors. So the pastors in the church really were that solid foundation for me to sit and talk with. When I reached my teens, 13, 14, 15, I started talking more, getting exposure to different men in the church. So where the biological father was lacking and guidance and so on, I got that from the church. I got that growing up, seeing other men, going to men's group, associating myself with upstanding citizens, men in the community. I talked to them, businessmen, real professional people, constantly being around. Another part of it is the guidance counselors in the school. When I was going to school in Jamaica, the guidance counselors and principals, usually most of them were men, they were very much close to me. I could talk to them about anything I came up with. And they used to guide me in career choices, as well as what does it mean to stand up as a role model for other students. So I was, even though the void was there for a biological father, the ideas and the concept of what it means to be a good man, what it means to grow up and to identify with somebody who is caring and loving, and yet not to lose your masculinity, and growing up our family, I grew up under those concepts, thinking that one day I'm going to put these things into action, because I don't see it in around me as in my biological father, but I'm going to live out these ideas, these ideals.
Your strong will towards becoming who you are is the blessing, perhaps, from the faith that you have. With 63% of youths committing suicide, 90% of homeless, running away from home. These are fatherless kids. 71% of high school dropouts. You have superseded and overcome the odds. And perhaps your belief and faith in the men of God and the men around you is a way up. We train young men right now in one of the toughest schools in the District of Columbia, in Ward 8, where there's a lot of shooting and killing. And I'm going to tell you something. They're hungry for fathers and men to teach them to be reasonable, responsible, and respectable. That's what a man is. That's who you are. And you should wear that as a shield and also as a badge that you have overcome some very difficult time, but you have to share it. As a good parent, as a good father, you got to reach out to somebody else and pull them in.
Mm-hmm. True. Very, very true. That's what I'm doing. That's exactly what I'm doing now.
So, Dwayne, is there a question for Frank or a comment that you want to add?
Yes.
I just want to add that the hope, there are so many men, you know, there is white supremacy and the crest theory run amok on black fathers, period, because it is the plan of some that we wouldn't have a father, that we would be fatherless and flounder in life. But the strength of it is that during this Kairos moment, it is written, a father is really the glory of his children.
Mm-hmm.
It's also written that in those days, he will turn the hearts of the fathers to the children and the hearts of the children to the fathers. That may not be your father, but you might be that father that these scriptures are talking to.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would encourage that men would come together in a place where we can hold each other accountable, where we can teach each other what is successful, and we can help to change the lives of our children and families by being available, affirming, and authentic. And I appreciate the pain you've gone through, but without pain, there can be no gain. And you continue to struggle, but your struggle has brought you to a victory. And I want you to know that, and I admire your courage to come and tell your story. But more than that, to be the kind of father that children can look up to, regardless of the circumstances that you have faced.
Okay, so Frank, we want to see if Dwayne has a question for you or a comment. So, Dwayne.
I appreciate your comment and your sharing. The point I want you to expound on, if there are organizations out there for fathers, not the ones who are actually needing help, and you reach out to them and empower them, but fathers who are actually doing the work, they're standing up for what is right. There are organizations out there, you know, like the club that you belong to, and they are this the brotherly club, you know, the brothers, and they support each other. If our listeners and myself too want to know more about these groups that you can become a part of, just to be in this clique of good men, you know.
Listen, I'm glad you brought that up. I happen to be, I'm the founder of a group known as the 100 Fathers, the Ordinary Men Doing Extraordinary Things. As a matter of fact, we just received the Hall of Fame Award in the District of Columbia for our years of service to the community as fathers and men. We're at www.100fathers.org. But I'm also a part of an international group that you can access called the Made Men, themademen.org, a 100-day call to action for men on criminal justice, on employment, on voter registration, on all of the things that will help us to be better at serving our families and children. And
okay.
So I would encourage you all to go online to the mademan.org and reach out to us. We're in 12 countries
mm-hmm.
and across the United States in about 18 cities. And we're doing this work with the evolution of the black man to lead
mm-hmm.
his people as
yeah.
responsible men, making a
mm-hmm.
difference.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a great question. I also
yeah.
have 1-800 number that sometimes you get in trouble. Sometimes you need help with parenting. And I'm trying to find that number for you right now. But we have, it's on my website, www.100fathers.org. We're,
mm-hmm.
we're connected with a group known as Parent Help. Because people always need help from
mm-hmm.
those that have been there, been down
mm-hmm.
the road, and can help you to do a better job at what you're doing. Here's the number, 1-800-716-3468. It's called Parent Help, Building Parenting Skills, Mediation, Opening Lines of Communication. That's who
mm-hmm.
we are. That's what we do.
And by the way, we do have the your web address on our webpage under portofharlem.net, and you go to the main menu and you go to Port of Harlem Talk Radio. You'll see Franklin's
mm-hmm.
name, and you'll also see Dwayne's name. You click on that, and you get the link to both Dwayne's article and also to the 100fathers.org webpage.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
So we're
we have a question.
Can you repeat that number? You want to repeat that number again, Franklin?
Yes. The number is 1-800-716-3468. Parent Help.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Help with
and
the kids, visitation, parenting, child support, court arguments, the whole nine yards. It's a group of national social workers that once you call, we'll try to locate help for you and help you to keep your family together.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so Franklin, I know that each individual situation is different, and I know you belong to different groups, but is there one main lesson your group or your groups try to share with people like Dice?
Yes. He is. He doesn't probably realize it. He's an exception to the rule.
Well, I think
as a matter of fact,
when you tell me how many people commit suicide, how many people are homeless, I think you made that clear.
Yeah. So people like him have to step up and bring another to the table of understanding, the table of leadership. We have to be able to teach our children that they come from greatness, to
mm-hmm.
respect their women.
Yes.
And we have to also understand that marriage is important. Marriage has fallen
mm-hmm.
off because
mm-hmm.
I think my son was asking me a question. He said, should a woman be submissive to him? I
mm-hmm.
said, well, she don't want to be submissive to you unless
yeah.
you know what you're doing. If you're not respecting
mm-hmm.
her, she's not going to respect you.
True.
So this is the knowledge and the wisdom that men
mm-hmm.
bring to young men, and boys need to be a man.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to share that knowledge. We have
mm-hmm.
to teach it, and we have to lead it by example.
Yeah.
And that's,
yeah.
We're master trainers, and we try to make sure wherever we go, we leave a path of leadership
mm-hmm.
behind
yeah.
us for others to follow.
So is your main lesson leadership? So is your main lesson leadership then?
It's leadership by example. But we
yeah.
have a curriculum we use that doesn't just mentor. We transform. And we study, it says in the Bible, study to show thyself approved. You want to be a good father? You got to study at it. You got to work at it. You got to know what to say and how to do it. And that's what we teach. We're fatherhood master trainers. People haven't figured that out yet, but pretty soon these women are going to be looking for a good man. That's what we try to do, create that.
Well, you mentioned earlier, fatherhood cannot be caught, it cannot be bought, and it has to be taught. So
yeah,
I guess that's in a nutshell. Is that correct?
That's it. That's why you have a father. To teach you the rights and the wrongs, to discipline you, to love you different than some of the research said that a father's love can be sometimes more effective than a mother's love because it's different. We discipline differently. We communicate differently. And that's valuable to the children to get both sides of the story. You know what I'm saying? So that's what we teach, and it works. And it works. So in this environment, when everybody's for yourself, the dad, I don't care what country you come from, the dad is still an important component of that family.
Yeah.
And
that is very true.
To make your lives better. So,
well, we're supposed to transition in 3 minutes. So, in these 3 minutes, Dwayne, can you say how this has affected the way you relate to your daughter?
What Mr. Malone said earlier on, it's real because it's no matter if you grow up with your mom alone, you have that tendency to wonder what the male figure would say or do. So you're really unbalanced when you're growing up with one parent. You're very much unbalanced because no matter how tough a lady is when she's raising a boy child, it's going to be missing the father component. No matter how tough she is, she's going to be missing it. So it's true. It's very true. Now, how I treat my daughter is to make sure that her mom is always there, even though we are we're separated for many years now. It's about 7 years now. To make sure that the mom is in her life and respect me as her father, and I respect her as her mom. And she knows this. She knows that I care about her. I talk to her all the time, especially when she's not with me. I try to see her. When I moved to D.C. from Florida, I call her, and I used to call her when I'm living in Florida too. I'm not seeing her every day or every other day. I would call her every morning and every afternoon, and it still works even now. And I try to fly back every 2 to 3 weekends to see her when I'm in D.C. to Florida. I made that out in my budget to do that for her. And then bringing her whenever she has any time. She could get 3 days off from school, 2 days or so on. She's coming to D.C. with me. And we go places. Every talk that I've traveled and I've done, she's always there right next to me from ever since she was born. She's right there in Jamaica, here, or anywhere. She's always there. And she knows that I care about her. And I talk to her as much as possible. She's 7 years old now. I talk to her. I get her stuff. But I made the connection of when I was growing up. I say, how do you feel having a father? How do you feel not having a father? And so on. Those conversations I have with her. And I said, make sure that you, when you get a little older, you understand the value of having me around. Because I know the void. I know it. And I promise her that I won't do anything to jeopardize her not seeing me or not having me around.
Okay, I had to slow this up and end this conversation, but I greatly appreciate your taking the time to write the story and sharing with our readers. And Franklin, I am so happy to finally meet you. I've heard good things about you, and I'm so glad that both of you were able to talk.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
Appreciate it.
It's very nice meeting you too, Franklin.
Thank you, sir. Let me leave you with this. Some men were born for greatness, to go above and beyond and do amazing things and wow the world. Thank you.
Yes.
All right. So we're going to take a 5-second break, and we'll come back with our next guest. Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you very much, Wayne. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to take a short break, and then we'll come back with our next guest. And our next guest is Lou Fields. 1 second. Okay, we're back. Lou Fields, are you there?
Yes, sir. Can you hear me?
I can definitely hear you. Welcome back to welcome back to Port of Harlem Talk Radio. That's speaking to my guest or our guest. And if you're listening via the internet, you can type your questions in the comment box. You can also call to listen by dialing on your phone at 516-531-9540. And if you want to also ask a question, after you are connected, press 1 and please be in a quiet place. You can also visit portofharlem.net and click Port of Harlem Talk Radio from the menu to hear this and past episodes. Lou is president of the African American Tourism Council of Maryland, an author, freedom seeker, and a lot of other things. But Lou, let's just focus on these two things today. And my first question to you, and I meant that he's involved in a lot of things. We're going to focus on these two things. And as head of the African American Tourism Council of Maryland, tell us what the pandemic has done to tourism business in Maryland and with your company in particular.
Yeah, thanks, Wayne. And first, let me thank you and your audience for having me as a guest tonight. And I want to applaud and let you know we appreciate your 25 years of being in the struggle and providing these wonderful lines of communication. I enjoyed the last guest you just had talk about fatherhood and men being in the children's lives. And some of the things we all do is to impact children and their development, hopefully their success. And what I do in my work, Wayne, I try to fill in the gaps as it relates to the sharing and preserving of our history, particularly in the state of Maryland, which, of course, has almost 380 years of history. And African Americans had a big part in this state as it did in the country. And so my nonprofit, which you, thank you for mentioning, the African American Tourism Council, I guess if you guys started around 1996, I had a mentor, Mr. Stephen Pace, who sort of helped finance the creation of our nonprofit. And the mission, Wayne, is to research, document, preserve, and promote the history of the achievements and contributions of African Americans in our state, and to use that product to entice tourists when they come into Maryland to go into those outlying areas where there are African American museums, African-American businesses, restaurants, retail shops, but they may not be in downtown where most of the conventions and the tourists may be. So through our work, we have developed tours, transportation services, referral services, and it's been a great journey. And I have to say, we got started right around the time you got started. We got started right after the Million Man March when Minister Farrakhan asked all of us to go back to our community and do something good. So we started this nonprofit to do that work, and that's what we've been doing since, I guess, 1996 now.
Yeah, but how is the pandemic affecting the business, tourism business in Maryland and your company in particular?
Yeah, I understand that's the second part of your question. And unfortunately, the pandemic has not only taken over a million lives, but it's also destroyed many businesses, particularly tourism. Because tourism is a travel, go to a place, meet people, go to attractions, be out in the open, and socialize when you're learning and traveling. And so when the pandemic really hit Maryland, I had just returned from Charlotte at the CIAA tournament in February this year. And that ended on March 1st. And by the time I returned to Maryland on March 5th, the governor closed the state down because it was such a drastic time as it is now. So for the most part, our businesses are down to zero as it relates to hotels, airlines, bus companies. Everybody's a little leery of doing group travel. And then everybody's also being asked, encouraged, or demanded to stay home. So for the most part, my tourism company has been suspended. We suspended all operations this year. I don't think I've done two tours, because by the time the COVID hit in March, we were looking forward to April and May and June, the tourism season. But by then, it was already cut off, and it's been cut off. And even now in my city, my mayor, new mayor Scott, has issued restrictions where restaurants cannot have dining or outside dining. It's only where you can get carry out. And so tourism, for all intents and purposes right now, is probably at its lowest level, even worse than the aftermath of 9/11.
So the two tours you had, that was before March, or was that after March?
Well, that actually was in February, and
okay.
I think I did one in October. I did two in February, but also do walking tours. I have a tour called the Frederick Douglass Pastor Freedom Walking Tour. So I think I did two in February, and a couple from New Jersey, the wife was celebrating her husband's 50th anniversary, and they pleaded with me to offer the tour to them, just two people, and I did that in October, but I'm used to doing thousands of people every year, and maybe 30, 40 buses coming in town and conventions. So you can really say we are almost close. We're really closed down, you know, just for safety as well as most of the public now. It's not really been enticed to do a lot of traveling.
Yeah, I was just wondering what group had the boldness to want a tour after March. But you said it was only two people. And I was wondering if you all had come up with some magical way to do a safe tour. And I guess you could do it 6 feet apart, but then if you have more than two people, one person be on one block and another person, and other people be on another block. So that wouldn't work too well.
But actually, it's really not even worth the risk. With the way this COVID-19 sort of transmits itself from strangers or even family and friends, the tour company is just put it to the side for a moment and let's work with our medical community, work with our elected officials and see if we can just get this thing under control before we go back to tourists, because that's a leisure activity. It's not something you gotta do. And so for me, what I decided to do was put a lot of in this new book. And so you can have a tour by book.
Yeah, well, let's talk about your new book. And I love how you made that transition because I know it's about Baltimore abolitionists. So my only question is, what makes this book different and what makes this book unique?
My book is unique in as much as it tells the untold story, historically accurate story, of the roles African-Americans and non-African-Americans played in the 1700s, 1800s, prior to slavery being ended in 1865. There were many unnamed people, unknown names, who sacrificed everything to help enslaved persons in Baltimore. I'm talking around 1700, 1720, 1730, going on to 1860 before the Civil War ended. Most people know the names Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman.
Exactly.
Those, they came 100 years late. It was others in the 1700s. Like my first chapter starts off with a fellow named Job. His father was Solomon. He was from the Gambia in Africa. He was captured and brought to Maryland in 1730. And he became one of the very first captured Africans who fought for his freedom. And his journey coming from Africa all the way to Annapolis, Maryland, which is Anne Arundel County, long before Kunta Kinte's story, the story of Job is a true historical story that most people never heard of his story. So I'm telling his story, and I go chapter by chapter with people who were abolitionists, some black, some white, who in the 1700s, again, 1800s, their stories have not been told. So I'm telling the story of Lil Green, who, just like Henry Box Brown, she shipped herself for freedom. Her story is a very unique story. I tell the story of Frederick Douglass' wife, Anna Murray. She was one of the first abolitionists, but her story is not widely known. She's just only known as the wife of Frederick Douglass.
Yeah, I never thought about her. Yeah, I never thought about her in terms of being an abolitionist. That's interesting. You just threw that in my head, and my head is burst, but go ahead.
Yeah, because what she did, when Douglass first escaped, she was the lady he met. Mm-hmm. She was a free black woman in Baltimore in 1834. And he met her at a certain abolitionist meeting, and she was a free black woman. He was a slave. On September 3rd, 1838, Douglas escapes. 12 days later, she's in New York, and she's married. She marries Douglas 12 days after he escaped. But prior to her escaping, she was a lady who raised the money to buy freedom papers Douglas needed to get on the train. She sold her bed and other items to help Douglas get the funding that he needed for his safe travel. Then, after they got married, she was married to him for 44 years, gave him 5 children, 21 grandchildren, and while Douglas became widely known traveling the world, all in England, all in Scotland, everywhere, she was at home raising the children, making money by making shoes and helping finance Douglas's travels. So she's in the background. So Freedom Seekers, my new book, sheds light on stories like that.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, because oftentimes, like you said, we don't hear her story. We don't know her as being the wife and the mother, but not the lady who was an abolitionist. And that's a new title for it. It's, well, a new title for me to put on her, and I appreciate that.
But the abolitionists were people who, they may not necessarily have been in the limelight all the time, some of them. They could have been behind the scenes. They could have been the Quaker lady who helped Harriet Tubman on her first escape. There could be a lady, the husband and the wife team who were white, like Thomas Garrett up in Wilmington. They couldn't always be out in the front because it could be loss of property. It could be shame in the streets. It could be public ridicule as well as violence. So to be a very visible abolitionist in the 1700s and 1800s had a high price you had to pay. So a lot of these stories people don't know about. But what people do know, the name Frederick Douglass, the name Harriet Tubman. Frederick Douglass's mentor was a white abolitionist named William Lloyd Garrison. He's from upstate, but he came to Baltimore to become under the tutelage of another abolitionist named Benjamin Lundy, who also came to Baltimore. So in my book, I make the case that Baltimore is really the birthplace of American abolitionism. But that story has not been told because the leaders of Baltimore over the last 200 years has not spoke to this kind of history. They want to act as if slavery didn't exist in Baltimore. So prior to me getting started doing my work, there were no markers in downtown or anywhere in Baltimore that used the word Underground Railroad. There was hardly any kind of notice. People walked right through a place that was a slave pen, a slave jail, a place where abolitionists lived, and you would not even know that. So through my tours, Black History Tours in Baltimore, I began to research and learn these facts. So now that the travel and tourism industry has been hurt so hard, what better way than to put this kind of information in a book so people can order it online? Those who love history, you want your children to know more about true history. And it's not just in Baltimore. This is a story that could be written in any mid-Atlantic eastern state because of the history of African Americans have not been told.
Okay, in our last 90 seconds, what's the name of your tour group and what's the telephone number and the web address, please?
Yes, primarily the company is the Baltimore African American Tourism Council. And under that, we have a division that does the Baltimore and elsewhere Black History Tours. The website easily is bdxlive.biz, which is bdxlive.biz. And that's where you can order my books, you can see the tour information, you can also see other stuff we are involved in here.
And you have a telephone number?
Sure. Telephone is 443-983-7974. And again, thank you and congratulations on your 25 years doing your work.
Yeah, it's hard to believe.
And Happy New Year and all that stuff.
Yeah, and it's hard to believe it's 25 years, but we thank our readers and our listeners for making it happen, and especially our advertisers. And you can see who our advertisers are at portofharlem.net and click advertisers at the bottom of the page. And we want to thank you. And that's the end of today's show. Visit portofharlem.net. And if you're on Facebook, please like us. And thanks, Lou, for your time.
Hey, Biggie Smalls, I'll be missing you, all the people we lost this year.
All right.
Thanks, Wayne.